Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is Lily Steele. Tonight I'm going to read from Manly Hall. And I'm not exactly sure. There's so many great essays here that it's very hard to choose which one I had thought of several possibilities tonight, but I'm trying to keep them within the here's one: The Five Virtues of an Elephant Trainer. Qualifications of a Spiritual Leader. It is remarkable stuff in here that just learning through the experience of living, adventure and curiosities, many faces of truth. Religion is all things to man. And there's just so many great things. But tonight I was going to concentrate on a lecture from 1972 by Manly P. Hall. And it's called The Search for the Unknown God, the Secret Power that Rules All Things. And let me begin here. It states that it is very difficult to trace man's various spiritual convictions. I think that they all arise from a series of observable circumstances, which individuals have interpreted differently. Man has two faculties which certainly distinguish him from other visible kingdoms of nature: memory and imagination. Memory invariably inspires a historical orientation, calling our attention to the enduring continuities of cause and effect, and making us aware of the consequences of conduct. Imagination, by opening the future, is a gateway into another dimension. Man always has created future conditions, good or bad, according to the degree of normalcy or neurosis within himself. Not only have men envisioned a better world than the one in which they live, but a great many have dedicated their efforts untiringly to advancing the cause of this better world. Had the human being found the material world in which he lives satisfactory, probably little attention would have been given to these two facilities and their products. However, our dilemma has been that the only world that most of us know has proved to be extremely painful, in that there is no clear pattern of fulfillment. A person cannot envision the relationship of himself to a pattern larger than the small circle from birth to death. Coming from a source pattern larger than the small circle, or a small cycle, rather, from birth to death, coming from a source unknown, living for a time in a confused environment, and departing into a future equally unknown, cannot be regarded as completely satisfying, and has led inevitably to the development of a worldwide neurosis. Man is neurotic. The degree of his neurosis depends, depending largely upon the circumstances of living and his own inner effort to organize and integrate his own resources. He who lives passively and does not really think, finds life acceptable, but not essentially fruitful. Those who think more independently, but experience too little, simply add to their confusion. Therefore, we seek an enlargement of understanding by which we can clarify the reason for and purpose of our existence. We take care of it for granted. We take it for granted that we are here merely to earn a living, in which case we would like to earn as much as possible, as quickly as possible. When we assume that our happiness must be equated with material possessions, we desire to escape all responsibilities which are objectionable, all involvements which are painful, and all processes which are unprofitable. In attempting our escape, we set up conditions for ourselves which gradually bring us to understand that in the end, these desperate efforts to make physical life satisfactory actually makes it more miserable. Today we are in a cycle of gratification in which physical security is considered to be the only answer to the question of what constitutes happiness, and happiness is thought to be the only condition in which physical life is endurable. Obviously, this attitude is short-sighted and must arise in the immaturity of man himself, a fact we do not wish to face. We do not want to accept the idea that we simply are not mature enough to make the plans necessary for our ultimate good. Having very little concept of what the ultimate is, we are unable to labor cooperatively with a purpose which we do not understand. Again, I'm reading, for those who might have joined us, I'm reading from the Search for the Unknown God, Secret Power That Rules All Things, a lecture by Manly P. Hall, copyright 1972. We could take it for granted that we are here merely to... We have observed that down through time, man has been given a vast cycle of experiences. The human being has experimented with very nearly every conceivable solution to the dilemma of his own existence. He has tried creating vast urban complexes and now seeks relief by moving into the suburbs. He has tried to find his happiness with people and without people. He has tried living with those who stimulate him and has found that the stimulation resulted in ulcers. He has tried living with people who agree with him, and he has found to be utterly impossible because basically he doesn't agree with himself. Here we are, then, in a world with which we are disillusioned, suffering from an epidemic of continuing and depressing misfortunes which dominate almost all our news media, penetrate our entertainment fields, and add some very strange undertones to our art and music, as well as surround us with pollution and narcotics addiction. These conditions indicate definitely that something basic is wrong. We always like to feel that whatever it is that is wrong, we are not responsible. Yet it is hardly possible to maintain this attitude any longer. More and more it is becoming obvious to most people that their problems arise within their own patterns of culture and subculture. They are reaping what they have sown. And we might say that if we want something better, such a discovery should cause us to change the type of harvest we plant. If we continue to sow weeds, we will reap weeds. Therefore, it is better to go back as deeply as possible into the cause of the problem, and inevitably the cause of the problem is ignorance. It is unpleasant and embarrassing to have to admit that a generation as overprivileged as ours is ignorant. However, the proper definition of ignorance is not lack of schooling, but lack of common sense. The individual who thinks things through constructively is educated. The person who depends entirely upon collective attitudes which have failed or are failing is ignorant. If we search for a way to combat ignorance, we will come face to face with the contributions of others of our kind who have faced the same dilemma to one degree or another since the dawn of history. History is really the story of man's groping his way out of ignorance. We must try harder to achieve the necessary ends, what is common denominator of our present attitude. Possibly the most common at the moment is criticism. We have reached a point where we are keenly aware of the shortcomings of one another, and we are beginning to sense that the various mistakes made by others are resulting in pain, misery, and danger to us. This naturally causes resentment, and we thus become critics of the behavior of one another, individually and collectively. We criticize practically everything that exists, and in the process of criticism, we are completely uncritical, condemning the good with the bad. In our disillusionment, we seem no longer to recognize the nobility of man, feeling that if we dig deeply enough into anyone, we are going to find something wrong or destructive. What we have failed to do is to dig into ourselves to find the same things. We are so much concerned with the mote in our brother's eye that we have no time to study the beam in our own. And criticism has become the principal function of the mind. We think of the mind as an analytical power, not realizing how heavily we have influenced by the conditions around us in society. Very few people think for themselves. They depend largely upon notions which have become socially acceptable. And as disillusionment and criticism are now socially acceptable, most of us just follow this path without any great amount of individual integration. Many feel that some type of social revolution is indicated as an answer to our problems, but all that revolution has done to date is to turn the barrel over, after which we begin taking the contents, which remain the same, from the bottom instead of the top. It was stated in ancient times that he who lives by the sword shall perish by the sword. Violence does not solve the fundamental problem. We also have a thought that the solution might lie in a great reformation in our institutions. Perhaps if we could reconstruct education from the ground up, we would have the answer. Or possibly if we could get our religious structure into a greater camaraderie, a purpose, visualizing religion as a unity of conviction rather than a diversity of creeds. We have considered, too, the possibility of political and sociological reforms by means of which the various levels of personal interest and ulterior motive which have afflicted us would be removed. Every way we turn, we are trying to put patches on an old garment, trying to take the consequences of our own conduct and twist them into a different pattern. But no matter what we do, the quality remains the same, and this quality is inadequate. We believe in hope, and there are many hopeful people, but for the most part, these people fail to recognize the essential principles upon which life is built. Where we hope for that which is not reasonable, we well may die of a broken heart. It is doubtful that we can change man by changing his world, yet this has been our hope. In order to change man by changing his world, we have attempted to provide him with physical comforts, physical securities, industrial and economic means of support. We have tried to make life pleasant and luxurious. We have come a long way in the developing arts and life pleasant and sciences to assist in the preservation of health. Yet in the past 2 years, this was written in 1972, the average lifespan around the world has decreased. Not because we do not have adequate science, but because other things necessary to health are not available. We have built up health on one side and pollution on the other. Surely we must have certain reservations about a way of life that is not farsighted enough to protect us from the inevitable consequences of wrong attitudes. No matter how we view the problem, there does not seem to be any real answer in the simple shuffling of our institutions. What is the basic religious answer to this dilemma? What is it that, in spite of all differences among the faiths of man, stands out as something held in common by all? I think that one of the most basic concepts of all religions is kindness. We think of kindness as a constructive relationship with other people. Like St. Paul, we can think of it as caritas, or charity, which has more recently been translated as love in the Corinthian epistles. And charity is, however, different than love. Charity includes something besides affection as we know it. First of all, it is quite possible for us to love God as a being without fault. But in mingling with our fellow men, we must mingle with them on the basis of charity. We must have charity for imperfection. We must have a kindly, compassionate attitude, and we must accept that the basis of a human relationship has to be mutual benevolence. To most persons, love is a word of far too personal a connotation, and it is applied very largely to degrees of human passion. This is not the way that it is used by the religions of the world. Actually, love is a deep and continuous concern for the good of one another. Love or charity is that which will prevent us from any action that is detrimental to the well-being of our neighbor. And according to the New Testament, if we cannot love our brother man, whom we have seen, how can we love our God whom we have not seen? And our problem today is that we are not really loving our fellow man. Rather, we only select certain persons whom, by relationship or compatibility, we regard with affection. Even this affection is fragile and is liable to be destroyed by unpleasant or negative conduct. Basically, our approach to life is not devotional. It appears, however, from the conditions in which we find ourselves that a devotional approach is the only answer, because our entire relationship with an unknown universe is one of faith and hope. The unknown God at the source of all things will not reveal itself on a scientific level because science is limited to material concerns. All that science can do essentially is to reveal to us something more of the transcendency of the invisible causing power. It may give us a greater respect for that which we do not understand, but ultimately it cannot confer understanding because it cannot transcend the level of its own experience. Philosophy, man's contemplation of life, can help. Human relationships result in a folk wisdom born of experience of ages of continuing contact between human beings. Out of this contact and a contemplation of its meaning springs philosophy, which is really just highly organized, scholastically integrated common sense. If it fails in common sense, it is not truly philosophy. And if it fails in idealism, it fails in everything. It rests very largely with religion to be the custodian of our attitudes. Religion is the foundation of certain moral life, certain ethical conduct, and certain ideal hope. It has not proven, and probably cannot prove philosophically or scientifically, the value of the great abstract foundations of existence. But such proof is not necessary. We do not need to know a great deal about abstractions. Perhaps it is nice to be so constituted that we can explore them in a moderate degree. But our real need is to know living as it is, to recognize the needs of the day and realize that if we live this day well, we approach tomorrow with a good hope. And the simple application of vital, intuitive realizations to the daily exercise of conduct. We need to recognize that constructive attitudes build, destructive attitudes destroy. Explanations, excuses, and rationalizations have no basic significance. Either the individual is working constructively or he is not, and there is very little need for a vast abstract framework in order to understand the simple daily requirements of constructive living. Man contemplating the unknown universe of which he is a part has from the beginning of time enthroned deity in the vastness of the cosmos. He has regarded deity as an infinite power, infinitely diversified through infinite time and infinite space. Deity has become necessary because without deity, man cannot explain himself, nor can he rationalize and justify constructive existence for himself. Regardless of the process of scientific skepticism or economic materialism, the individual, in order to live, must have faith in something beyond himself. He has tried to transfer his faith to his physical institutions, and they have failed him. Man's only enduring security is his faith in a supreme power of good. Without this faith, he is lost. Some may say that the necessity for faith in a supreme power of good is not justified, but let that point rest. We have to say that man cannot exist without faith. His need is greater than his rationalizations. We must believe in an infinite power. This belief sustained to a degree by the phenomenon of existence. We know, as we look out upon the universe, that certainty, we could not construct it. We also realize that our short durations are such that we cannot manage it, and our only hope is that whatever is there is great enough to take care of us. Contemplation of this mystery has brought man to the recognition of what has been called cosmotheism, that is, the infinite unknowable as God, an infinite that contains all that is known, with all that is known gradually fading into all that is known, the known and the unknown together constituting a hypothetical reality, and this reality being the sovereignty that guides us all in all things. Recognizing that this vast unknown outside himself, man has touched one half of the mystery. But there is another half equal to the first and just as difficult to explain. The life which man himself, man is suspended in a mysterious way between an external unknown and an internal one. Probing into the root of his own existence, he again finds a mystery. He discovers that he cannot go beyond a certain point. He recognizes that there is something within himself as inscrutable as that something that abides forever in the abstract dimensions of space. Somewhere during his existence, man, in a moment of intuition, made a decision that was greatly to influence the human family from that time on, namely that the unknown on the outside and the unknown on the inside are one and the same. If we are able to send our consciousness far enough into space, we might discover God. If, on the other hand, we were to go deeply inside ourselves, it is conceivable again that we would discover God. If we do not wish to be theistic, we can affirm that both the outside and inside may be defined by the simple term life. Aliveness, a condition of existence that never ends. We say never ends with certain reservations because really we are not capable of conceiving of any end any more than we can find any other type of ultimate within the scope of our understanding. If things seem to be reasonable, life must essentially be one. We sense, therefore, that somewhere in the infinity of things there is one essential power, and this has given rise to monotheism. This essential power manifests through an infinite diversity of processes, giving rise to polytheism, and these processes are knowable through the constant unfolding of life in the visible sphere of existence, which gives rise to pantheism. All these procedures, as far as we can trace them in our own experience and observe them in the working of natural law, sustain the belief that there is one basic life, that although this basic life is an absolute unity, diversity may rise within it. This is a basic Pythagorean statement. Man has come to conceive of himself as a manifestation of the same one life. He sees no reason to affirm that this life, which maintains vegetation and is present in the great sequoia tree, or is to be found on not only in the structure but in the habits of the animals, is not in man also, because man is part of the vast pattern of things. Gradually, we have come to assume that within man is life, that this life is a spark of eternal life. In some cases, we have philosophized this, perhaps a little too enthusiastically, to assume that this life in man is a seed of eternity, a seed of the infinite creative life, and all growth and manifestation is a process of seed and unfoldment. The Chaldeans referred to all the seeds of eternity as seminal processes giving rise to generations within themselves. In time is sown the seed of eternity. In nature is the seed of heaven. and man is the seed of his own perfection. This concept appears in one of the writings of the Germanic mystic Boheme. He refers to the seed of the soul, a tree of life with its seed in the heart, and under which is, as is the oasis of the desert, all things gather for nutrition, shade, and the protection in time of trouble. However we wish to view it, we are inclined out of our common experience for ages, to assume that the two unknowables are the infinite expanse around us and the infinite intensity within us. These two are conditions of one thing, because man is a part of life and is a germ of eternity himself. There is a rapport between man and the infinite. The two mysteries are linked in origin, and man can never be separate from the unknown universal of which he is a part. He may not know this. He may not be able to escape from his personality into that larger realm at any particular time, but the potential of eternity is in every seed germ in space itself. Man is a particularly unfolded seed of eternity. On this basis, many religions have developed that what has been termed mystical or esoteric structures. Esotericism is a term covering that which simply is not generally known or communicated. We have assumed that it is a protective term by which we prevent the individual from penetrating secrets of some kind. But actually, it is a universal process, inasmuch as there are no secrets from those who know, and so-called secrets cannot be revealed to those who do not know. Finally, the search is for a bridge between an infinite in man and the infinite in space, and something by means of which the individual can escape from the terrible pessimism that locks him, also from the bondage to the material sensory perception by which he is held in slavery to the physical processes of living. So far, the only escape man has been able to experience that is within the range of so-called normal physical relationships has been death. Only in this way has the hypothesis, the hypnosis, of material existence been broken. That nature has established this termination of mortal ambition seems to indicate that nature does not want ambition to go on forever. If it is true, as the ancients believed, and I think also intuitive people believe, that there is a spark of eternity in man, something that makes him want to grow, to long after truth, something that wishes him to ascend above the ordinary and to reveal out of himself a nobler and more vital purpose, the problem then is there any way of bringing these two extremes into a greater familiarity or a greater intimacy? I think the ancients had a very good answer, one found everywhere in religions and philosophies. Those who live a kind of life that is appropriate to growth will grow. Those who do not live this kind of life will remain bound to the sphere of illusional existences. Man must try more and more to escape from the limitations of particulars and ascend to the comprehension of generals or universals. If we unlock ourselves within a relative existence, we will have great trouble breaking through. We must attempt to attain a comprehension of universals. One of the first of the world's great thinkers to attempt this was Egyptian Pharaoh Akhenaten. He was perhaps one of the first civilized human beings, and certainly he is one who is realized for the first time that all religions are aspects of one seeking, and that all human beings, regardless of their conditions, are manifestations of one life. Therefore, the brotherhood of man is the eternal fact. Conflict is the non-eternal delusion with which we have the burden ourselves for far too long a time. The comprehension that we must act more like the universe if we wish to understand it has inspired a great deal of effort to break through the smallness of our conceits. We do not know the universal, but we can observe some things about it in nature. And everywhere the universal power is moving every creature toward the unfoldment of an internal potential. In other words, the infinite around us is causing us to become more and more aware of the infinite within us. And the whole purpose of evolution appears to be the revelation of a man's own internal divinity. If we don't wish to use the word divinity, we don't have to. We are concerned with a principle, namely that the power of universal process is demanding the growth of man's internal superphysical potential. In regards to this process, we might borrow the idea from the alchemists of the Middle Ages. These are some plates and figures in some of the old works which show the garden of chemistry. Here all kinds of beautiful flowers are growing, and in the midst of them is a mystic rose of universal love. This beautiful garden represents nature, and in the same figure, an old man with a watering pot is helping to keep the garden in good condition. He has a rake and a hoe, for he is the gardener. He is the alchemist. And by larger extension, he represents humanity. And man as a gardener is a cosmic world garden. In a cosmic world garden, he is man's privilege and purpose. It is man's privilege and purpose, as the alchemical aphorism goes, to assist nature in the perfection of its labors. Man is here to cooperate because he has the faculties, necessary to gain the essential insight which will cause him to realize that this cooperation is necessary to his own survival. Man is indeed the gardener. He is the power by means of which the labor of art can be advanced. Art was the name for alchemy and described as the art which perfects nature. We are therefore primarily concerned with advancing the universal purpose, sharing in it, growing with it, and by so doing, hastening the day of our own liberation from the miseries and misfortunes which originate in ignorance, superstition, and fear. Man's primary reason for existence is to serve. He is here to find his joy and fulfillment in the continuing experience of an unfolding life, which is more beautiful and meaningful as each of its mysteries become more apparent to him. Man's labor is not to advance his own purpose, but to advance the purposes that are. We see what happens to the little purposes of man. We see nations built up and fall apart, societies grow and fade away, races become prominent and gradually diminish. All these labors of man are short-lived, whereas the labors of the infinite are eternal and immortal. Can we in some way, within our capacities, discover some of these things and structures our lives accordingly? I think the important phrase here is within our capacities. This is where a great deal of optimism has failed and many wonderful opportunities have been overlooked. We have to recognize that our growth is according to our own insight and that we have gradually unfolded the abilities we seek to use. I am convinced from over half a century of working with people that the average individual is essentially an honorable person. I am convinced that nearly everyone wants to live better than he actually does, that every one of us in the course of living experiences his own futility, that we are aware that we are insufficient, that when we would do something gracious, a negative spirit within us often impels us to an unkind word or deed. Essentially, man knows his need, but he has carefully trained his consciousness away from this knowledge because he has felt that a life dedicated to principles which result in material detriment, that he will not succeed in this competitive existence of which he is a part, and which is to last only a short time. ultimately causing him to exit therefrom into a universe in which competition is meaningless. By his competitiveness, therefore, the individual is actually preparing himself for a fight which does not exist. He is overlooking the possibility of preparing himself for citizenship in a universe of realities. I think the answer lies in the only obvious link we seem to have, the kindness dwelling at the root of us. We want to be kind. The answer to nearly every problem we have is with is the simple recognition that there is within us something of that divine feeling with which we are enveloped at all times. That whatever this power is at the root with which we are enveloped at all times, that whatever the power is at the root of life, it is good, wise, and benevolent, and has as its final purpose of the as the final purpose the perfection of all that lives. As beings, we do possess something of this same feeling. But the trouble is that we have submerged it, educating ourselves away from it and putting it in place a highly competitive, destructive relationship in which we have sacrificed the common sense of good for an unrealistic attitude of exploitation. Consequently, most religious systems and the mystery schools of antiquity are typical of this process. Are not, as some people consider them, institutions of higher intellectualism governed by priestly despots. Rather, they are institutions of self-discipline, making possible the revelation within the individual of something more of his own eternal potential. And the purpose within the individual of something more of his own, the purpose of discipline, rather, is to clear the individual of the false values with which he has surrounded himself. Okay. I'm reading this along. I mean, it's great. I'll probably go over it tonight. But I hope that somebody's getting something out of this. I am by reading it, and that's, I guess, what's important. And when I do read stuff like this, I'd like to share it with other people because it's so damn amazing, and at the same time, it's secret, you know. I mean, I don't know where people are going to get hold of this. I never read any of these lectures, private lectures of Manly P. Hall, Philosophical Research Society, California. I mean, remarkable works. Lectures that he gave, and only probably gave once, you know. So, remarkable works. And I hope that you enjoy hearing them. Today our personal situation is just about the same as the general one we have with pollution. We are reaching a point where it is obvious to us that something must be done to break this pattern of continuing human thoughtlessness and selfishness. When we get into such an emergency situation, we have to set up laws, because we cannot depend upon individuals to cooperate voluntarily. Voluntary cooperation interferes with economics, and there are a great many persons who do not only wish to die rich, but intend to attain wealth regardless of its cost to others. Laws are passed, rules are set up, fines and penalties established, and there is a concerted effort to meet the situation. We make the same response to practically all the social difficulties that confront us. The only answer is change, and the only way that we have as yet found to cause a change has been discipline. When personal living becomes so polluted that we cannot endure our lives, and whether this pollution is simply due to wrong attitudes, or whether we have polluted the body also with narcotics, sedatives, and tranquilizers so that we hardly know whether we are conscious or not. When things reach this condition, there is only one answer. That is self-discipline. Because many of these problems cannot be handled successfully by society, and were not intended to be. Each individual's salvation rests upon
rests finally in self-discipline. Self-discipline is not a higher intellectualism, but a realization that what is necessary must be accomplished or a very dismal disaster lies ahead. This is exactly the state that man at the moment. It has always been the key to growth, but growth never has been the primary objective of the individual. He has been more concerned with the expansion of his temporal power. Discipline must take over in the life of the well-intentioned human being. He does not need to know where he came from. He does not even need to know where he is going, although perhaps such insight might further encourage him. What he needs to know is that he is in trouble and that the only way to get out of this trouble is to stop causing it. This is hard logic, whether we like it or not, and is well supported by facts. Thus, the person has to begin the process of controlling and directing his own attitudes. This is the secret of the Zen and also of the mystical organizations of antiquity. Control need not take the form of a terrible enforcement. A program of self-control is not a farewell to all joy, but the beginning of a goodbye to misery, although we may not see it in the light at first. Self-discipline could mean simply to relax, though simply understanding a way from that which is wrong. What we understand correctly, we will do. Understanding can exist in many levels. It is not going to be perfect at the beginning. The immediate understanding must be that the individual is to shift his foundation from the continuance of destructive policies to the experience of constructive values within himself, which he is perfectly capable of doing. A child of 12 can do this if adults have not conditioned him adversely. There is no problem whatsoever. The gracious life is the most healthy, rewarding, meaningful, and religious one. It is the life that builds a bridge between the graciousness of man and the grace of God. And the human being who lives a kindly, loving, intelligent, gentle way of life experiences something of the wonder which Solomon felt when he beheld the lilies of the field. Growth is natural. Growth is a continuing revelation of divine love and beauty. Unless man, with his own wrong attitudes, causes an early frost to blight it all. Each person who is really sincere is looking for some solution to the isolation that is the cause of his pain. Far more important than understanding God is simply to have a gentle love of life itself, a relationship not of veneration of the abstract, but the true relationship of a child to a good parent, the relationship of respect and confidence built upon the strength of the parental or creating power, a perfect faith in the inevitability of good, and a perfect hope for the perfection of all that lives. These attitudes do not require rationalizations. Rather, they are inherent. They are natural and inevitable if we will permit ourselves to have them. We block these attitudes through the development of selfish intellectualism. We rationalize our way out of the truth that would bring us peace. We try to weigh the disadvantages, and generally, we select that which seems immediately pleasant, even though the consequences may result in misery. If we can gradually experience love for God, we will know the meaning of divine love. If the individual is capable of reaching out with gentleness, beauty, and faith toward the infinite, we will find that the infinite reaches toward him with exactly the same feelings, attributes, and qualities. Man seeking safety will find it in the acceptance of the safety of the divine plan. If he is lonely, he will find the eternal friend in the indwelling, ever-present, and omniscient power of truth. If he is tired, he will find that in the universe there is no exhaustion except that which arises from the misuse of energy. If he faces the future with uncertainty and transition with doubt, these uncertainties and doubts will fade away as true love of the infinite causes him to have a total acceptance of the divine purpose. Our link, then, by which we can at least experience the infinite, whether we understand or not, is through complete acceptance of the divine purpose. I might be able to make this. As I think I got three more pages left here. I'm going to try to finish before the end of the show tonight. This acceptance is very easy. Why we have been given so much trouble finding it is hard to explain, except that we have to fight against the primitive neuroses within us. We have to fight against atavistic fears, the conditioning of thousands of years of social process, which was essentially wrong. Yet those thousands of years cannot injure in any way the spark of eternity within us. It can, however, cause us to develop physical, mental, and emotional patterns which imprison rather than release the power that is locked in our own consciousness. We were given bodies so that the plan of life could manifest through them, but we have so conditioned ourselves that we have used these bodies to represent and express suffering and death. We have not allowed the body to be a perfect instrument of universal purposes. We have made it into a prison for life rather than a magnificent temple in which life can express its own purpose. The troubadours did not even adopt the idea of the body as a temple. They pictured life as a garden open to the sky and liked to think of the gradual transformation of man's life from many kinds of cloistered existence into a free life in space as part of an infinite beauty of things. Man can do this. If we scan the history of art, music, and literature, we find transcendent beauty. Man does indeed understand beauty, and many human beings have loved not only well, but wisely. There has been tremendous sacrifice to the cause of principles. Within every living creature, there is sublimity. Something so magnificent, so youthful, so tremendous, that we cannot even define it. The time has come, then, to try as individuals to reach out in sympathy to life rather than to rationalize it. First, probably one of the simplest and most beautiful experiences of this kind is found in the parent-child relationship. The sincere parent finds himself transposed from a self-centeredness to a child-centeredness. The little life, which is the beginning, is so helpless to a child's becomes a fulfillment. The individual finds his own maturity in bestowing opportunity upon others. To protect this growing life is a natural impulse. It is a nature's own way, and nature is the greater teacher of all that lives. It has given the human being an insight into the glory of sacrifice, of fulfillment, by turning the mind from the ego to the contemplation of opportunity to serve. It is a very simple thing, if only we could realize it, and not a vast structure that might take centuries to master. It is essentially nothing more than the goodness given a chance, and we are going to have to give this goodness a chance. If we have not charity, we are as sounding brass as a tinkling cymbal. Everything depends upon the ability of the individual to reach out above his own self-interest to the common good. Love is the secret. Without love, knowledge is a peril to all. Without love, industry becomes tyranny. With love, it is a means of maintaining the material world with dignity. Statesmanship without means of maintaining the material world, statesmanship without love is despotism, but with love it is parental guidance of people to the fulfillment of their own needs. And many statesmen of the ancient world pointed this out very clearly. One of them said, "That leader is great whose people do this out very clearly." I'm sorry. "That leader is great whose people do not fear him, but fear for him." This is the difference of a point of view. Without love, the statesman and businessman fail. With true love, the artist, musician, and poet fail. Where selfishness takes over and we interpret the divine plan only in terms of its material symbolism, we sow the seeds of our own undoing, and we have been sowing them rather industriously lately, and it's time to begin to sense the values. I have to wait 1 second here. Turn these loose leaf pages. We got about 10 minutes left, and I think I can get done with this. So, it is the mysterious alchemical power of love that transforms the base elements of society. All who have made great contributions to mankind have done so because of an immediate internal pressure to do that which is good. Each one in his own walk of life has opportunities, and we all make use of them sometimes. What we need to do is to make use of them more often. We need a more continual expression of value. I think we would find, as the mystics of old found, that as our own inner lives quieten and the pressures and problems become less because of quiet acceptance, we will discover peace, not the peace as we have commonly known it, an arbitration between conflicts, but peace as a condition of man's well-being, a peace in which there is no longer irritation or pressure from attitudes or circumstances. The individual is not necessarily freed from burdens, but he is freed of the psychological pressures of the concepts of burden, and what he has previously regarded as an odious chore suddenly becomes a beautiful privilege. And the individual is not imposed upon. He ceases imposing upon others. Therefore, he is no longer so keenly aware of impositions. If the individual can come into a quiet acceptance of life, he is like the forms of a life everywhere around him in nature, which welcome without question the light of the sun, the ray of the moon and the stars, the motion of the seasons, and all the various changes by which nature regulates its processes. Everything that is valuable comes to the individual who accepts, and the individual who accepts in these larger terms is the one who has discovered God in all that happens, an eternal purpose in the various mutations of mortal existence. And acceptance of this requires no explanation, and he who finds it will never have to name it. It remains unnamed. It is something that is larger and more important than the terms that we can create. I think, then, that the mystery of the unknown God lies in the fact that it can be known only by that which accepts it, and it can be accepted only by that which loves it. But it can truly develop the necessary love in man only when man, in turn, learns to maintain a creative relationship with those around him. It is a universe ruled by love rather than by force. In many philosophies, love comes in as a factor. We think of the universe with its laws. We think of the deity as the great lawgiver. We have created a dichotomy of law and love. This is totally false and entirely a matter of our own thinking, largely due, perhaps, to fear. For in the world, law has become a legal code, difficult to administer, and with many inequities. But universal law actually is the primary manifestation of universal love. These two principles root in one. The infinite plan, which is law, is the perfect manifestation of the infinite compassion. The law exists in order that love may have its perfect work. They are identical. All law is love, disciplining that which it loves, just as a parent must discipline. And love is not in any sense different from its discipline, but in fact it loves enough to discipline. Universal law is not cold and arbitrary. The idea that it is an impersonal, infinite, soulless, and heartless a mass of scientific exactitudes which govern existence by a computerized system is false. On the other hand, there is an evidence that all things and all laws labor together for the common good. Law within ourselves to discipline ourselves. The child is disciplined by its parents. The adult is disciplined by his own consciousness. And when the parent administers discipline, it is because of love. When the individual disciplines himself, it is also because of love. He is doing so because by this act, he worships. Worship is the individual becoming like that which he worships, living according to its laws. In the Indian philosophy, for instance, each deity has associated with it a flower or symbol, and the worshippers of that deity present this flower or symbol as their offering. Associated with one of the deities is the lotus, the symbol of infinite compassion. The devotees bring to the altar a lotus of his own to accept that he is worshipping by practicing the virtue of that deity, and his offering is the compassionate deeds he himself has performed. There is nothing to do with the formalization of symbolism, of symbols. The individual believes, practices, and his deeds are his offerings to the infinite. As we unfold our potentials, we may not immediately solve the mystery of the unknown God, for veil upon veil after we lift the fine, veil upon veil behind. But one thing is certain, we will be moving toward the fulfillment of the infinite purpose. We will be moving away from our own superficial attitudes to those principles which are necessary to the purpose for which we were intended. Man will never find happiness until he fulfills the reason for himself. The reason for himself is that he shall transcend himself and reveal the divine through himself. And this revelation will result in a perfect organization of his society. Until we know this and practice it, we shall not have the results. There is nothing in this that requires a vast or elaborate technical structure. We do not need to know all mysteries. We do not need to answer all riddles. What we need to do is to realize that we are part of a structure that has rules. We can see these rules in operation. Although we do not see or understand them all, we see enough to know that it is to know what is next. In keeping these rules, we worship, and through doing the good deed, we pray. And through the gradual attainment of inner tranquility, we release the divine purpose through ourselves by increasing our own internal intuitional powers. When the individual's ego relaxes, the need, the seed of eternity in him will speak. This voice comes from the greatest of all oracles, the oracle of the heart. We have gradually learned this. It is not incomprehensible for a child and should not be impossible for an adult. But in order to understand it and live it, making it an integral part of our lives, we must quietly and thoughtfully contemplate the simple progress of existence. We must sense the infinite of which we are a part. We must be ourselves we must see ourselves as the children of a vast life principle, growing up in that principle, reaching our maturity when we keep its rules. We keep its rules, we must certainly practice the charities of life. We must live with a good heart and a good hope. We must keep faith with all that lives, and we must develop a simple, natural, internal compassion for our fellow man and a true love for the divine plan of which we are a part. By these simple processes, we can transcend most of the difficulties of this generation. And with 29 seconds remaining, we are finished the lecture. And that was, the name of that lecture, by the way, was, yeah, what was it?
bit, 7 seconds. The name of that lecture was The Search for the Unknown God. And I thank everybody for listening, where we've stopped streaming. But I just completed The Search for the Unknown God, Secret Power that Rules All Things, a lecture by Manly G. Hall. And that was lecture 163. And published by the Philosophical Research Society, 1972. So I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. I hope that that interested you. And please join me again tomorrow night when we have George Dixon with us. And we will be discussing further the esoteric schools, as well as the Mayan calendar. And we will discuss more of the amazing aspects of being within the sixth night entering, or in the sixth day, rather, and soon to be entering the sixth night of the Mayan calendar of the galactic period. So we thank you, and join us tomorrow night with George Dixon and Lila. Thanks.